Welcome to Britain's only weekly FM radio programme about design and transport. Hello, I'm Mark Ovenden. We're chatting art, transport, communications history. That's CATCH. I call it the Catchcast. And we're hoping to get you as fascinated by our wonderful, if a little bit geeky subjects, as myself and the fascinating guests. In this edition, we are connecting live to America to speak with two authors who are changing the way the country thinks about one of its most well-known obsessions, the automobile. Welcome to the Catchcast, Sarah Goodyear and Doug Gordon.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, thanks to you for being here, both of you. And we're going to cover your new book, Life After Cars, Freeing Ourselves from the Tyranny of the Automobile, and your excellent podcast as well. But I wonder if we can start by taking you both back a bit to your upbringings and ask, how did each of you get so fascinated by the subject?
Okay, I can begin. I grew up in New York City. I grew up in Manhattan, and I never had to get in a car to do anything. I went everywhere on foot and bicycle and the bus and the subway. And I just grew up with that baked into my life, that active transportation was part of my life. And then later on, when I moved to different parts of the country where that wasn't available, I realized that I didn't want to live without the ability to live without a car. And so I would say that it was just kind of something that I took for granted as a child and then came to realize was actually a very precious thing.
Mm-hmm. How about yourself, Doug?
Yeah, I grew up mostly in a suburb north of Boston, Massachusetts. I grew up on a cul-de-sac, no sidewalks, off of a very busy road, essentially a state highway. And I was, like a lot of American kids, driven everywhere. As soon as I got my driver's license, I, you know, was dependent on the availability of my parents' car. And so after college, I ended up moving to Atlanta, Georgia to follow a girlfriend down there and loved the city, but hated the driving, sort of like Los Angeles without a beach, basically traffic in every direction. And then eventually moved to New York, where I had some family and lots of friends. And as soon as I got here, I got rid of my car and was just so much happier. I don't think I could have articulated it exactly, but so much of it really was due to the fact that I could take transit, I could walk, you know, I commuted by subway to work, and making plans with friends was so much easier because we weren't all lugging these big metal boxes around with us and having to store them someplace while we went to a bar or out to do something after work. So that's sort of like my quick way into this stuff. But I was also a bike commuter too, and that really showed me a lot of the city and how it worked and how it didn't work at the same time.
Did either of you think about or study or take any kind of academic interest in public transit at all when you left school or while even you were at school?
My background professionally is in television production. I was an English major in college. In my television career, I have done a lot of science and history documentaries, two things I'm interested in but never studied. And that actually was a very big asset for me as a television producer because I would often say to the people that I was interviewing, this has to make sense to me if it's going to make sense to a general audience. And as I got interested in cycle commuting and urban design, it was kind of the same philosophy of like, I need to figure out how this all works without the academic jargon that is often associated with describing how it all works. And so as I got involved with activism and safe streets advocacy and was writing about this more and getting more interested in it, reading about it more, I was seeking out ways of understanding that were just more accessible to the average human being.
And I'm going to ask Sarah, because I think you became a journalist, but Doug, can I just hold you on that point a little bit? When you were a TV producer, did you find any cheeky ways to sneak in a bit of extra transit or subway shots or cycling?
You know, it really would depend on the show that I was working on. I did do some stuff on science and material science for our public broadcasting system here. And I don't think I really snuck too much in there, but I would try to, when I would travel to shoot for these shows that I was working on, I would sort of say like, maybe we could find a good subject in Amsterdam that I could go, you know, interview. So then I could, in my free time, explore the city.
Nice. And Sarah, let's come back to you. I believe yourself, you became a journalist for a while.
That's right. Well, yeah, no, that's been my career. I got my degree in film theory from the Comparative Literature Department at the University of California, Berkeley, but didn't do much with that degree. I just went into journalism because reading and writing is what I can do. And that's one of the ways that you can make a living doing that. And I was a general interest journalist for a long time. As part of that, I certainly covered my share of zoning board meetings and planning commission meetings. And then in the early 2000s, I started writing for an outlet called Streets Blog that was founded by the co-founder of our podcast, Aaron Napperstack, and started writing about urban planning and design. And at that time, there was a lot of interest in those topics here in the United States. And that became my beat. And the great thing about covering that beat as a journalist, really, if you're covering urban design, urban planning, transportation policy, you're pretty much touching every single important thing that happens to people in their lives. And it just really became a way for me to explore so many interesting topics, so many important topics. And that just became, for the last 20 years, that's what I've covered as a journalist. And that's what led me to the podcast that we all started together.
And we're definitely going to get to the podcast and the book, but just to hang on that point of media coverage, because certainly in this country, and don't know enough about your historical media coverage, but it certainly feels like transport is not given the amount of coverage it needs to, given what you've just said, Sarah, because it actually touches everybody's lives.
It's the one thing that everybody has to do every day in some way, shape, or form. And it's been neglected terribly, but I think that really has changed over the last 20 years since I've been doing this as a journalist. I've seen a real surge of interest in this topic and a new understanding that the way we design our transportation infrastructure, the way we design our communities is not just a series of accidents. It's not preordained. These are choices that we make, and these choices reflect our priorities as a society.
Exactly. It's about choices. We are going to get to your fabulous book in a second, but can you give us a flavour of one of your other interests, the one about making the streets safer, please?
Yeah. You know, I started cycling to work in the mid-2000s, 2006, 2007. And by 2010 or so, I had started a blog called Brooklyn Spoke. And part of the reason I started it was because I was noticing all of these changes that were happening on our streets. And this was during the tenure of Mayor Bloomberg, who had appointed Jeanette Sadiq Khan as the Department of Transportation Commissioner. And, you know, it was one of those situations where I would bike to work and one day there wouldn't be a bike lane on my commute and the next day there would. And I started to get interested in, well, how did that bike lane get there? What does it take to change streets and how does it all work? So I started writing specifically about that, consuming as much media as I could about it, reading Streets Blog religiously. And at the time that I started this, there was a kind of parochial fight about a bike lane pretty much in my backyard here in Brooklyn, Prospect Park West, which is a street that lines Prospect Park, essentially Brooklyn's Central Park. And like a lot of things, it was very controversial. Many people in the neighborhood, while there was tons of support for it, there was a minority of folks who did not support it and filed a lawsuit, in fact, to stop it. So I was covering that on the very granular level, while Streets Blog was covering the bigger fight over bike lanes and safe streets in New York at the time. And that just sort of threw me headfirst into the waters of transportation advocacy and safe streets advocacy. And everything sort of spiraled out from there. I just got more and more interested in it. I started writing beyond Brooklyn Spoke. I started becoming a kind of spokesperson for the livable streets movement in my backyard. And that's what led me to meeting Sarah. That's what led me to meeting Aaron, our former co-host, and starting the podcast.
Well, this is an inspiring story of community roots standing up for improved cycling and transport and better streets. And we could probably do with a little bit of that here in the UK as well. Today, we are tackling a crucial issue. What is our dependence on the car doing to culture, to society and the planet? We are lucky enough to be connected directly to Brooklyn, New York City, where two brave authors are tackling this subject head on. Sarah Goodyear and Doug Gordon, you've set a bit of the scene for us strange old Brits, but just how addicted to cars are some of your fellow American citizens?
Well, I would have to say that they are addicted not by choice, but by compulsion. And, you know, we're talking the vast majority, the upper 90-something percent of people in this country live in places where just by design, they are forced into car dependence because there's just no alternative. So we have an entire nation that is filled with people who might want to have other choices and do want to have other choices. But because we have designed everything expressly for the convenience of automobile drivers at the expense of everyone else, they don't have those choices. We're in a pretty sticky situation here in the United States. It's definitely a level of car dependence that I think is unfathomable to many, many, you know, more developed, wealthy nations. You know, they just don't have to deal with this.
Is it really that bad, Doug? Outside of New York City, you know, you've lived in Atlanta, you were saying earlier on. We see New York on the TV and films and stuff with the subway and your new mayor who wants to make the buses free. I mean, how much transit is available in some of the other average U.S. towns and cities?
Oh, well, it really depends. You know, yes, New York is kind of an exception where we have 24-hour subways and bus service and a lot of walkable neighborhoods. You certainly have that in some parts of Boston, Chicago, San Francisco. But outside of a small handful of cities, you know, you really are dependent on a car, no matter your income level or anything like that. And it is bad. And like Sarah said, it's a forced dependence because if you talk to people, they don't want to be so dependent on cars and all of the expenses that go with that. But yeah, you know, we've been traveling North America during our book tour, and we've been in cities from San Francisco down to Houston, Texas, where if you took Sarah and me, two Brooklynites who live car-free, and plopped us down there and said, okay, you live here now, we would have to purchase a car because mm-hmm. it would just really mm-hmm. be the only way to have full enfranchisement in society, to access food, healthcare, education, employment. So it is this forced car dependency. You know, in the book, we talk a lot about the idea that Americans have a quote-unquote love affair with automobiles. But like Sarah was saying, it's a forced, an arranged marriage, let's say. And that phrase itself, love affair with the automobile, was cooked up in a 1960s infomercial that aired on NBC. So even the way we talk about cars in the United States is influenced by Madison Avenue and the car companies themselves.
It's all about big business, really, isn't it? I remember a couple of trips I've been lucky enough to take, and I've never had a car when I've been there, and I've always tried to rely on public transit. And then I end up perhaps walking on a sidewalk, and then the thing suddenly runs out. And you think, how do you cross the road? Where do you walk? What happens next?
The average trip distance in most parts of the United States is under 3 miles, which for an able-bodied person would be completely walkable, if not, you know, bikeable on an e-bike especially. But it's really about the quality of that walk or bike ride. So something could technically be close, but if you have to deal with sidewalk-free streets or you're walking next to a very busy 3 or 6 lane road, even if there are sidewalks, you're not going to want to do that every day.
Yeah. And what I often say is there are walkable neighborhoods in the United States of America. Unfortunately, pretty much every walkable neighborhood in this country is incredibly expensive to live in. And the effect is that living in a walkable area has become a luxury good, something reserved only for the rich. I personally believe that being able to move around your community under your own power, to have good access to public transportation, safe sidewalks, safe bike routes, I believe those things are a human right, and many, many parts of this country don't have access to that. And it is the people who have less financial resources that are forced into more dependence on cars, which, of course, is punishingly expensive new vehicles are now more than $50,000 to buy a car has become incredibly expensive to insure. And of course, fueling a car also is quite onerously expensive. So you're taking people who have the least financial resources and telling them the only way you can get around your community, the only way you can go to your job is in this incredibly expensive motor vehicle.
It seems utterly crazy. So you produced this fabulous new book, Life After Cars, Freeing Ourselves from the Tyranny of the Automobile. How do you argue the situation could be improved?
Well, the first thing we need to do is just talk about it and see it as a problem. As we were alluding to earlier, most people in North America and certainly, you know, even in the UK and Australia and other places don't even see it as a problem to solve because it's just the way things are. There's nobody alive today who knows a life before cars. All they know are cars everywhere. And so they assume that it's just part of nature almost. And so the first real step is to have these conversations and say, you know, there are places in the world that are doing it better, where people have more freedom to not have those big car payments or not have their lives structured around needing to get into a car all the time. I think that's really the biggest thing that we argue for in the book is just see that it's a problem.
Mm-hmm. And Sarah, do you think that there are other things that can be done? Is it just about putting in new transit and cycleways in the future, or does it need that fundamental change of mindset that Doug's been talking about?
There is a fundamental change in mindset that needs to happen because for so long in this country, we've stigmatized the very things that can solve these problems. Putting in sidewalks, improving bus service, putting in bike lanes. Those are the very things that are stigmatized by the pro-car forces, by those who accept those forces without argument. So I think it is important for people to fundamentally realize, hey, this situation is one that we have constructed at the behest of a lot of powerful forces that include multinational corporations. And this is something that can also be deconstructed. And so many of the fixes are really not that expensive, that complicated. It really is as simple sometimes as improving frequency on a bus line that already exists or putting in a crosswalk that actually functions. Cars will come to a stop to let you cross the road. Mm-hmm. These are not radical ideas. These are not expensive, onerous things that we have to figure out how they work. It's all proven technology. It really is a question often of political will, and that's where the change in mindset really has to come from, the grassroots up, pushing elected officials to realize their constituency is inclusive of everybody, not just drivers and not just people who want only to drive.
We've been discussing how the car has influenced our lives, and we're still connected with Sarah Goodyear and Doug Gordon in Brooklyn. They are the authors of a new book called Life After Cars, but they've also been running a podcast on the subject since way back in 2018. It's got a slightly different title to the book, hasn't it, Doug?
Yes, the podcast is called The War on Cars. And I can hear some of your listeners switching the channel right now. But no, that title comes from the cry that you often hear people say, you know, anytime you want to make a street safer and you put so much as a crosswalk and take one parking space, or you take 100 parking spaces and put in a bike lane, or 1,000 parking spaces and put in a new bus lane, you're accused of waging a war on cars. So when we were trying to come up with the title for the podcast and figuring out the tone and style of the show, it was Sarah who said, you know, this is sort of the podcast about that, about the war on cars. And we were like, boom, that is the title. Because we wanted to kind of not have it be a rather serious discussion all the time, although we do cover some very serious topics. We wanted to broaden it out to all the ways in which cars affect society and culture and all the rest. But we also wanted to, as advocates, reclaim a phrase, the war on cars, for ourselves and say, hey, wait a minute, cars kill 40,000 Americans every year and they cause all kinds of problems in our society. Why shouldn't there be a war on cars?
40,000? May I just interrupt you? That 40,000 people killed?
Yeah, you know, that's not including the people who are seriously injured in automobile crashes and have life-altering injuries. That doesn't include, obviously, the health effects such as asthma caused by air pollution or other things just from sedentary lifestyles that are the result of car-centric design. So, you know, the ways in which automobiles are waging a war on people are numerous.
Yeah, but, you know, I really appreciate your shock at that number because it's not just 40,000 people. Obviously, each one of those people as an individual with family, with friends, colleagues, and the ripples from one of those deaths go out into the general population. And pretty much everybody that I know in the United States of America has known somebody who has died in a car crash. It's just not that unusual. And our per capita rate of motor vehicle death is about 13 per 100,000, which is roughly double what it is in most other wealthy developed nations.
Crikey.
It's simply a level of violence that is widely accepted as the cost of doing business in the United States of America. And we just find that unacceptable and we won't accept it and we won't be quiet about it.
Very good. Why should we pay that cost? That's just shocking. Absolutely shocking. Can we talk about some of your episodes?
Sure.
I did notice you did a two-parter recently on President Dwight Eisenhower's Federal Aid Highway Act. Now, for those of us over here, what influence did that have over there?
Yeah, I think if there is a moment in history where the United States locked in car dependence, it was with the 1956 Federal Aid Highway Act, also the Interstate Highway Act. And that was seen at the time as the wave of the future. The 1940s and 1950s, the post-war period, the United States went all in on automobiles because it was seen as this technology that was going to usher in this incredible new future for us. The World's Fair in the 1930s, there was an exhibit sponsored by GM, the Futurama exhibit, which talked about traffic-free highways and automated highways and self-driving cars that would be available as soon as the 1960s. And Eisenhower himself had, of course, experienced the Autobahn in Germany as a commander of the forces in the European theater and as the person who oversaw much of the reconstruction of Europe in the post-war period. And he kind of marveled at this Autobahn system and said, you know, we need something like that in the United States for national defense, to move people in large numbers. Obviously, this is during the Cold War. The threat of nuclear war was something that was felt very deeply. So all of this money was allocated towards highway building, much of it up for grabs, paid for by the federal government, available to states for free. And states and cities went all in on this highway building spree. Unfortunately, unlike a lot of the rest of the world, where our highways were built around cities and then you took other modes to get into city centers, in the United States, we, and I use that word because we are all dealing with the effects to this day, chose to go through a lot of city centers, largely for racist reasons. You know, this was the period of quote unquote urban renewal, where cities were seen as places where Black and brown people and poor people lived. And if we could plow through their neighborhoods, it would get rid of the blight and the slums.
Wow.
But of course, it created more of those things and left a lot of these communities just completely decimated. We talk about in one episode, the 15th Ward in Syracuse, which at the time in the 1940s and 50s was home to 80% of that city's Black population in upstate New York. And this highway was built right through it and just wiped it out.
Wow.
And there are just hundreds of thousands of homes and people and businesses were destroyed all in the name of progress. And what we question in those episodes and in the podcast in general is progress for whom, right? Progress for suburban commuters, maybe. Progress for the people who lived in those communities or who still live in those communities? Absolutely not.
Yeah, and I'd like to add that one of the most shocking things that we've encountered as we've been on the road is just this sort of physical reality of that this has not stopped. So when we were in Houston, when we were in Austin, those are two cities in Texas that are still widening freeways that go through the city.
Oh, dear.
And in Houston, they're losing, I think, 1,100 homes. Hundreds of businesses are being affected. And once again, these are in minority, financially disadvantaged neighborhoods. It's really just the insanity of doing the same thing twice. You know, hey, let's add another lane to a 22-lane freeway.
What? Let's add 22 lanes. Yeah, that's madness.
Yeah. And there's still this idea, even though we understand the principle of induced demand, that adding another lane just adds traffic in the end. But we're still doing this at the cost of billions of dollars and the destruction of people's homes and businesses. It's incredibly frustrating. However, there are places in the United States where some of these freeways are being taken down, or some of these communities are being reconnected. But this is a fight that's very much ongoing.
Mm. They did that in Boston, I believe, didn't they? With the big dig, they buried one of those dreadful highways.
Yes.
You guys seem to have a bit of time for how some of us crazy European do things. And you had a big episode with the mayor of Paris. You did an interview with her. How is she shifting the dial there?
Mayor Anne Hidalgo is justifiably legendary in the active transportation community because of her incredibly persistent and thorough redesign of Paris, one of the great cities of the world to begin with, of course, but now immeasurably more pleasant and healthy to live in over the last 10 years. So the mayor has added bike lanes everywhere, added school streets. Take the street in front of a school and you say, no, cars can't go here. We're going to make this a place where kids can play, where they can exit their school safely and into a pleasant environment that includes greenery. And the air quality in Paris has improved. The number of people riding bicycles has exploded. And you have now the banks of the River Seine are a park instead of a highway. You can swim in the River Seine again because it's clean. And she's done all of this in the name of improving the quality of life for her constituents. And she's been laser focused on that. And that is something that she spoke with us about in the interview. Just her belief, if she keeps quality of life as her guiding principle, then everything that she does can be justified and explained and end up benefiting people so that when it happens, despite they've had to push back there, they've had motorists organizations suing to keep cars on the banks of the Seine. They've been through all that, but it's the clear vision and persistence of someone like Anne Hidalgo can make the difference for the millions of people who live in and visit a city. And it's really inspiring. I think other leaders should look to her and ask themselves, do I have this kind of courage?
Yeah, absolutely. I lived in Paris for a bit and it was clogged with exhaust from cars and it's so much better now. You also did an episode with a chap I met over there, the wonderful Jonah Freemark, and he spoke about whether buses should be free. Is that a route we should go down all over the world?
Well, I think it really depends. I was, before we did that episode, probably a little opposed to the idea. I'm a little more open-minded about it now. You know, our mayor, Mayor Mamdani here, he ran on three central planks, and one of them was fast and free buses. So he wants to make our entire bus system free to use. There's a debate to be had. If you talk to bus riders, what they really want is buses to be frequent and fast and reliable. A free bus is great, but if it only comes every 15, 20 minutes or it's stuck in traffic, that's not going to do you much good. What's important about the discussion that Mamdani is having is that he is centering bus riders. Sarah had said earlier that transit users are a very maligned and neglected constituency in most cities in North America. And that's true even in New York City, where we have very good transit and the majority of people get around by subway and bus. So the fact that he is saying, you know, we need to do something for bus riders and that bus riders are as important, if not more important in many ways than car drivers, gives me hope. And I'm excited to see what he can do, because just having the conversation, if he doesn't get every bus line in the city free, but gets some of them free and improves service on most of the rest, that will be a huge win in my
book. Big step forward, absolutely. Yeah. A particular bugbear here is car bloat. Is there any pushback coming, apart from the wonderful Anne Hidalgo, against the sheer crazy size of SUVs?
Yes, some cities are looking at having higher parking fees and other fees. I believe Washington, D.C. has done something about this for SUVs. But in the United States, I would have to say that the hegemony of the oversized sport utility vehicle, so-called, is almost complete. The size of the vehicles that we have here, I think, would astonish you, because when I was in London, I had somebody point out an SUV as being particularly large to me. I said, I got to tell you, that's a mid-sized vehicle in the United States now. So I'm 5 feet, 6 inches tall, and I regularly encounter vehicles where my nose is at the top of the bonnet.
Oh, my.
You know, so we're talking these huge vehicles. I do think that there is a growing understanding that we need to build in some disincentives to having these vehicles on our streets, because they're so costly in terms of they're much more likely to kill people. They take up a tremendous amount of curb space. If you do want parking at the curb, you know, we're talking about these very long vehicles that take up as much space as 1.5 or 2 other smaller vehicles. And also they create an enormous amount of wear and tear on our roads. But right now, these vehicles are very, very profitable for the U.S. auto companies to make because of some loopholes in our laws. And so right now, it's just a cash grab. It's forcing consumers into making choices that they might not have wanted to make. There's no American auto manufacturers making sedans any longer. If you want a sedan-sized vehicle, you have to buy one from Japan or Korea. Mm-hmm. So again, people are being told this is what they want. There's aggressive sales campaigns that go on all day long on television, every other medium, and people don't really have much choice about the kinds of vehicles they're going to buy if they're buying a new vehicle.
Goodness, what a shame. Go to my last question here, Doug and Sarah, although I could carry on talking to you for hours. Transits, high-speed trains, cycle lanes, green energy, I think someone at the top of the country there calls them windmills. They've both taken quite a lot of knocks in the last year or so, haven't they? How are you feeling about the future chances of our lives without cars?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that we are facing major political headwinds, which is probably the understatement of the century right now. But I remain optimistic. I wouldn't keep doing this if I weren't. As Sarah said, you know, when we began doing this, we were kind of the weirdos talking about bike lanes and transit and clean energy and things like that. And a lot of the issues were very siloed. The environmental movement, the transit movement, the bicycle movement were all very separate. And now they're all integrated. Everybody is starting to understand, or more people do understand, that housing is made more expensive when you have to include parking. Or if you build things far away from each other, it means you're forcing people to purchase an automobile and all of the expenses that go with that. The fact that these things are targets by right-wing government here in the United States and elsewhere actually is a sign that we're winning in my book, because it means, you know, if they weren't trying to squash these things, maybe we wouldn't be making as much progress as we were earlier, if that makes sense. You know, I think they're a big target now because they are popular. And I think one of the things that's happening is that the more, for example, the Trump administration goes after windmills and bike lanes and active transportation projects, I think the more it gets people paying attention, say, hey, wait a minute, this is what you're taking away from us. This is what you're spending your time on. We saw that happen locally with the bike lane fight here in New York, that as much as the cranks and the opponents got a lot of attention in the media, it actually activated a lot of people to say, hey, wait a minute, you just want to make it safer for kids to bike to school? Who could be against that? That seems so strange.
Exactly.
So I think that that actually is where I retain my hope. As bad as things can get, it is activating people to pay attention to these things in ways they didn't before.
Yeah, and I would add that we've been, again, all over the country to the most car-centric cities. And what we have found there is a robust and active and growing advocacy community that's demanding better. And I think that what we're seeing as the federal government has devolved and become an actively hostile force toward our American cities, what we've seen is almost a resurgence of pride and a sense of possibility inside of American cities, because I think that being under attack has helped us to understand just how precious it is what we have in our cities and the communities that we have and the ideals that we have for a pluralistic society. I think there's a very strong sense in the United States of America right now that those of us who live in these cities, which is the majority of the population of the country, are very focused on defending those cities and making them better, protecting our neighbors and decreasing income inequality. And like Doug said, there's all sorts of new alliances that are forming under the pressures that the federal government is putting us under. And I would actually also point to congestion pricing, which has now been in effect in New York for a year. When it went into effect, the Trump administration immediately, it was one of their first targets once they got in. They said, we're going to make sure that this policy gets reversed immediately, and we're going to take money away from New York. Well, none of that has worked. And the policy itself has been resoundingly successful. It's improved air quality. It's improved drive times for drivers. It's put money into the coffers of our transit system so that we can make important upgrades for people with disabilities and extend the system. And all of those things happened when we were under the most attack by the federal government. And we had local officials, including our governor, who hasn't always been great on things, but she was great on this. And she stood firm and she said, no, you are not telling New York what to do. And so I think that there's a sense of pride and hope. And I personally, I sometimes shrink from calling myself an optimist, but I guess I am an optimist. And what I am not is a doomer. And I reject the idea of doomerism and saying, oh, this is all going to hell in a handcart and we're just going to lie down and take it.
This
is the time to fight, right?
I absolutely love that word. I'm glad that neither of you are doomers. That's fantastic.
We would wrap it all up if we were. I think we'd pack it in and just go to a beach somewhere.
There is so much more we could talk about. These fascinating areas we can go on for a lot longer, but we do have to stop. It's been a privilege to speak to you both, Sarah and Doug. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, likewise. It was really wonderful to speak.
If you've enjoyed listening to these guests as much as I have, then Life After Cars, Freeing Ourselves from the Tyranny of the Automobile by Sarah Goodyear, Doug Gordon and Aaron Napastek is available in bookstores or search it online. For their podcast, simply look for War on Cars on your favourite podcast platform. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. We're doing more chatting art, transport, communications, history. Please do join us then.